September 5th, 2010, is the Watt from Pedro Show.
Thank you.
Watt from Pedro Show. Sunday, day before Labor Day, September 5, 2010. Started off the show with John Coltrane doing Untitled Original Zero. Started off the show with Mr. John Coltrane doing Untitled Original 90320. And then something new from Good for Cows called Material. Hey there, Comrade Devin. Just back from touring with Stooges. Had some great gigs. Very wild time working a new machine. Mr. James Williamson had built for me. Mr. Brian Michael built it, luthiered it. Kind of after my favorite ones to play gigs, these old Gibson EBs. And Jason Lawler wound the pickup custom for it. So these last batch of gigs were U.S. ones, and it was very interesting. Get to play home, and only one gig I didn't wear a flannel. This guy Song got me a black cotton thin shirt. He thought maybe I'd sweat less. I didn't. And then it got all shiny when it got wet. It was Chicago at the Riv. I wrote about all these gigs up on the Hoot page, MikeWatt.com or HootPage.com, HOOTPAGE.com. And I got my tour spiel chimped up in diary form there about these gigs that I did, that I got the honor of being part of, really. I still more than 7 years in it, and still pretty wild for me. Of course, I love it, all the gigs. All the time I get to spend with him. It's a beautiful time for me. I got some Missing Men coming up. Yeah. A Japan tour. October 17 to November 7. 22 gigs in 22 days. For my new album. It's my third opera called Hyphenated Man. And it comes out October 6th in Japan on Parabolica. I've been working a little while on this, so I want to tell people that's it. And then you get to play all those gigs. Buddies of mine, Light, love them. Dearly, dearly love them. And they'll be the one consistent band. We'll be playing with all kinds of cats out there. But every night we'll be sharing the stage with Akinori, Nobuyuki, Kozo, and Brother June. And Kusudo-san's getting it all together, and I just thank the world of them to let me come over there with Tom and Raul, who are on their way home right now. They've been out with Lou Barlow and the Missing Man. They've been touring while I was with the Stooges, Iggy and the Stooges. So we start pracking on this piece. Now it's got 30 parts, and each part's got a lot of parts. So it's a little bit of something. My knee is still the port side, not that happening. Like, I can't run any marathons or even pedal the bike yet. But I can bend it, and not a lot of pain. But it's slow going, because, I'm less younger. Before I went out on this last bunch of Stooges gigs here, I went to Austin, Texas first. Not Dallas. Sorry. I was invited to be part of a collaboration with Colin McDonough's, Tim Barnes, and John Dietrich. Well, I got to talk to him, too, for the radio show here. So I'll have spiels. First, I'll play some music by each of them. You know, I'll play some of John's music. You'll hear John spiel and Tom, Tim, likewise. And, this really happening man, Nicholas Taplin, first post-consumer label, wanted to just, throw these cats in his little studio there in Austin and just go for it. And, it was great. It was a little sweaty. I wore the gym bay all 3 days. But they're all three remarkable cats. Very fun to be around. Of course, I couldn't really leave the pad because of my knee and stuff. So I spent all 3 days in there. I never left. I went in the backyard a little bit and got way bit up with the mosquitoes. But most of it was in there, and some good times, good jams, bunch of laughs. I think I got him psyched to The Prisoner. The first night we got some takeout Chinese chow was brought, and I got a fortune cookie that said, "Don't forget, you were always on our minds." And, that was kind of, I don't know, maybe it's more innocent, but it's trippy. That's what made me think of The Prisoner. Well, the first guy I spieled to, John Dietrich, and we'll play some of the music he's done, and then have the man speak in his own words about his journey through music, a lot from Pedro's show. We'll be right back.
August 26, 2010. I'm here in Austin, Texas, and I didn't get a chance to do a radio show, but I am going to have a chance to talk to some gentlemen I got to record with the last 3 days. There's no name for this proj, is there?
No, not yet.
So an unnamed proj in Austin. We're missing one. Drumming man Tim Barnes is out running, but he'll come back all sweaty and be very glad to talk with us. But for now, it's John Dietrich and Tom McDonough's. I guess we'll get to the proj later. I want to get to the music thing. John, when did you first become interested in music? Not making, what about just even hearing it? You remember?
Right. I think I remember I...
You were in Wisconsin, right?
Yeah, I was in Wisconsin. My first experience was hearing my grandpa play. He played... he would play old standards and things on the organ.
Oh, righteous.
And that was always amazing. So whenever we went to their house, they had their organ, and I'd always beg him to play. And if he wasn't up to playing, then my brother and I would sit down and start playing with the sounds, you know, like coming up with some weird sounds or pushing like drum machine or whatever, you know. And I think that's kind of how we got started. And then I took some piano lessons early. I did 3 years of Suzuki Method piano.
And what, like grade school?
When I was like 5 through 8, I think.
Wow! Oh,
like real early. And then I didn't want to continue. My parents let me stop.
It was your idea to take them?
I don't think so. Yeah, I think it was their idea. But I could be wrong about that, actually. I don't really remember.
Me either. 5 days is very cloudy.
Yeah.
Period for me.
Yeah.
But you start going on music, you let it go. Did you start getting records?
Yeah. The first record I remember getting is the Flash Gordon soundtrack. Queen. I just remember seeing the movie and just feeling like the music was just unbelievable.
Wow. Know?
And so I got that. And then I didn't buy a lot of records, though.
Yeah.
My brother bought tons of records, and he turned me on to everything. I mean, he was one of the first, you know, punk kids in my town, and so he, you know, my parents were really cool about it too. So they'd let him record in the basement, and his friends would come over and.
Oh, because he's playing.
Yeah, he played bass.
Ah.
He plays bass. He's an amazing bass player. And so...
But back in those days, while you were taking the piano, was he playing?
Actually, he also took some lessons at the same time. But then we both stopped that.
Yeah.
Maybe he went a little longer than I did, actually. And then on the same day, we both rented instruments. He got a bass and I got a guitar. I think I was probably maybe 10 or something.
Yeah, what brought that on?
Just listening.
On the same day we rented, like what happened?
Oh, why? I think it was his birthday, or it was something for him. It was his deal, and I think I cried and
get
screamed.
One and do one too.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, and he was into it too, because then it would be somebody for him to play with, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So we drove to Wausau, which is like half an hour north, and went to the rental place and picked out. Instruments.
What about amps?
I don't even know if we started with an amp. I can't remember. I don't think so.
Tell me, D. Boone started no amps.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
We had these pawn shop electric guitars.
Yeah.
Boy, they're kind of quiet.
Yeah. Exactly.
Must be some studio gimmickry that those right.
Exactly.
Are
how do they make it so loud? That's when you know you're really good. It gets loud.
That's what we thought fuzz sounds. We didn't know about effects pedals. We thought that was all studio
wizardry. Right.
So, you come home with the instruments. Did you start writing songs? Or did you copy records?
I copied records. I took a couple of lessons. And
you took guitar lessons.
Yeah, I took lessons for maybe 2 months. Yeah, he was actually great. He was a really nice guy.
What's his name?
Stephen something. Steven, yeah, I don't remember his last name.
Okay, it's all right.
And then I was really into it, and basically, though, I think, you know, I'm really into it. I took lessons for maybe 6 weeks or something. And then I played for a little longer, and I kind of lost interest. I think basically there was a creative aspect that was lacking for me.
We're talking about 10 years old, right?
11.
11 years old.
Yeah. And basically, I stopped for maybe 6 months and started really missing. Basically, I think what I was discovering was that I needed a creative outlet, and I didn't know exactly what I wanted at the time.
Yeah.
But then my grandpa had I went over to my grandpa's and was rummaging around in the basement, and I found an old acoustic guitar. By this time, I didn't have an instrument anymore. And I was rummaging around, and
what happened to the guitar?
Well, it was the rental. Yeah, yeah. And so I was looking around, and he had an acoustic guitar in the basement, and so I just started playing that, and I wasn't playing it to learn songs. I wasn't playing. I was just like every night before I went to bed, I would just like pull it in bed with me, and strum. I mean, turn off the lights and just strum and start to come up with little ideas of things. And then every night I put it on the ground and I go to sleep. And then
a great image.
Yeah. And then the funny thing is, like, not funny at the time, I went to bed one night, did that, and I was kind of a rough sleeper. I fell out of bed and smashed it until it cut open my side.
Wow.
And then it was like I ended up having to save up some money to buy it.
That's why I conk on the deck. I would roll around and fall out.
Yeah, yeah.
I never heard it. Bass or guitar, but I hurt my face a lot.
Yeah.
And so I said, fuck this.
Yeah, my brother fell out of a bunk bed once.
Oh! I know some cats like that. Yeah, what was his name? Some guy in Needy Houser, man. Yeah, busted out his teeth.
Yeah.
Fuck. But anyway, okay, so you go and you buy another guitar because this guy got broke.
Right.
You're like in a junior high now?
Yeah.
Yeah. Just one man thing. Does your brother still have the bass?
My brother has the bass, and well, he's going crazy. I mean, he's playing in all these bands and doing all this recording experimentation in my parents' basement with four tracks and like, yeah. I mean, and he's very active, and I'm obsessed with everything that he's doing. You know, I go to every one of his shows, and it's really, I mean, some of the only music of its kind in where I'm growing up. So I, you know, really, really kind of out there, you know. And
but you're not in a band or anything.
No, and I didn't want to be. And I didn't know anybody my age that played music at all.
Ah, okay.
And, I mean, I was into sports and stuff. I played, you know, all kinds of, well, mostly soccer, but like, and so, but the guitar was just something I did on my own. It was never intended to be anything.
Pre-cog ritual.
Yeah, totally pre-cog.
So when did that change?
That didn't change till college, actually. I mean, I never played with anybody else, other than a couple times, like with my brother, maybe one of his friends.
Like jams?
Yeah.
Did you ever write songs?
Yeah, I was writing that whole time. Oh, you were? Yeah. And just like weird little kind of instrumental, like, I don't know what you call them, like...
ditties?
I don't know what they are. Just like guitar songs, I mean.
Yeah.
And
ditties, is that a good word?
I think it's a good word.
Ditty.
Yeah.
It's not like self-important, you know, my work, my piece.
Right. Exactly.
My ditty.
Yeah. Exactly.
What are you talking about?
Yeah.
A little one.
Yeah.
And then in college it changes.
Oh yeah, and basically, I had these dreams of being a professional soccer player. I start college, and I mean, I wasn't like, there was no reason I should have had those dreams. Other than that, it's fun and I love doing it. Yeah. And so I was playing college. I could, I, Basically, after a year of college, I decided that I wanted to, that I should either focus my energy very intensely all the time on soccer or on music, because I was finding myself more and more like I wanted to spend my time doing music. And so I moved to Minneapolis. I transferred to the university there from
Golden Gophers.
From there, that's right, the Golden Gophers. And then just started looking for people to play with and things. And
yeah,
started,
there was like, a scene there.
Yeah. And
I knew some guys, Hoosker.
That's when I started meeting some people.
Yeah. And started playing.
Started playing, yeah. That's the first band. So the first band.
So what's the first band you were in?
It's still going, actually. It's called Gorge Trio, and it's with my friends Ed and Chad. And that I met them. Actually, my roommate did a temp job with this weird guy who had these huge headphones and listened to really crazy music, and he was like, I bet you'd like my roommate, he plays guitar. And so he told my roommate, or gave my roommate she told him he was playing a show, and we went and saw his band play. It was him and Ed and this guy Nate, all three of whom I'm still friends with, and Nate is now like this amazing astronomer, but Ed and Chad, anyway, we have a band together. Oh. And it's been going for like 15 years. Oh shit, I knocked him out.
Did you record then?
Oh yeah, okay. Yeah, we started recording.
Is that the first band
right
you
away,
recorded
yeah.
With
we basically band? Started out just improvising together a lot of the time.
Come on.
And what happened then? I don't know. Then we started another. The three of us also. We met this guy Nick, who was from St. Louis, who had this band there called Dazzling Killman, and that band had broken up, and he had moved to Minneapolis, and he joined with us, and we started a new band called Colossamite, and that went for a while.
Tour.
We toured. In fact, that's how we ended. We toured the U.S. and Europe, and at the end of the tour, we ended in Hamburg, Germany, and Chad, the drummer, stayed there, met a woman the next day, and has been living there ever since.
Wow.
Yeah. And
that's the way to end a tour.
Yeah. Well, actually, even before we knew Chad was staying, we knew the band, like, the band kind of imploded anyway, so.
But that's your first touring?
Yes.
Yeah, wow.
Well, Gorge Trio played some, like...
Little regional.
Like, yeah, we played, like, Iowa City or...
Yeah.
No, it's not... Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. And you guys are improvisers. You're writing, like... You're pretty engaged in creating.
Yeah, we were writing material for it, too.
Yeah.
But our focus was just on, like... We were really into all these, you know, like, European improvisers and...
Yeah.
And, like... You know, Peter Brodsman is, you know, this kind of thing, like, real energy, like...
Were you taking classes at the college about music?
Not about music. Well, for the most part, no. I took one actual music class in college, and University of Minnesota, you get one class that you can drop, and they'll remove it from your record.
Right.
And for me, that was music theory. I was getting a D, and I was just like, all right, forget it.
Were you still doing the soccer?
No.
Yeah.
You mean now or then?
Oh, no.
Yeah. Yes.
I kind of thought maybe now, but
yeah,
I was guessing probably. But I was wondering, so you'd made the decision, no more soccer in college.
Yeah. I was just
right.
Focused on this other thing.
This band breaks up Colossamite.
Colossamite. Everybody thought that. It was a flawed name. Yeah. No, it is. It really was. It was an error in judgment that none of us foresaw. Amazingly.
It became quickly apparent.
The next music chapter for you after that?
I was... looking around, I was working at the graduate school after I graduated from college, and I was just, I had started this job while I was there, and I had time occasionally to look around on the internet, and I was just looking for something, like, what can I do next, you know, and I was looking into finding music programs, but specifically electronic music, because I was really interested in electronic music, and I was making... I was playing around with electronic stuff and like kind of collaging sounds and all this kind of thing, and I wanted to see if there was maybe someplace I could go and actually learn more about it. And I found out about this college in Oakland, California called Mills College.
Oh, yeah.
And I applied to there and miraculously got in. And then moved there and started school. I met Greg on my first day of school, the drummer for Deerhoof.
Yeah, right.
And we had a class together, and we started doing these things where after class...
He went there? He's from Oberlin.
He went to Oberlin, and then that he
which was,
that was
a
for
music
undergraduate.
Trip, right.
But yeah, that was a conservatory.
Right, I played there a couple times.
Yeah, yeah.
There was gigs there.
And we would, like, maybe four or five of us would get together after this one class, and we just play music for each other, listen to things that we were working on, and he played a Deerhoof thing that he had.
Because he had that going.
Working on,
right,
yeah.
Right.
And I played some Gorge Trio things. And it was exactly at this moment where Rob and Kelly were leaving to move to Alaska. And so he was like, would you maybe be interested in playing together? And I was like, yes. I loved that
so
music.
So that's the next band after Colossum.
Yeah, yeah. Colossamite.
Colossamite.
It's okay. It's better. Actually, in Italian, it's great. Colossamite.
Oh,
in Italian, it's great. Colossamite.
Okay. It's just like something big?
Yeah, yeah. Our singer invented that word.
Okay.
He's good with that.
I thought it wasn't good.
I know.
No, he's good. He's good at it, but then, like, it's just hard to pronounce. Or it has certain connotations.
Yeah, yeah. It starts like another word.
Right.
Okay, so you start playing.
Yeah, right, so I started playing. And then, yeah, I never graduated from there. Greg was in his second year, so he finished his year out. We played at his thesis concert.
Yeah.
And then...
As Deerhoof?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and he had a broken leg, actually. He had broken his right leg, so he had to play bass drum with his left leg. So we were doing shows like that, too. It was. I think it was good still.
Yeah, yeah. But when did you start recording with him?
Pretty much right away.
Right away.
Yeah, because that was one thing, we had access to the recording studio at Mills.
Yeah.
So we would. That's where we recorded like a lot of the stuff for this album Reveille, which was the first one that I played on.
Was it Econo?
Yeah, 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 yeah. Well, I mean, they had some nice stuff, and we didn't know how to use any of it. And so, like, we did everything wrong. Like, you know, I decided it was you needed two mics on the guitar amp, which is a fine idea, but then I never checked the phase, so they were completely out of phase, I had them hard panned. And so it's just like you put the thing in mono, and the guitar completely disappears. And so we were just like, oh my god,
dude,
like, how did we do this?
Dude.
And all we had was stereo mixes when we left.
Yeah,
that
but you were young and just starting.
Yeah.
I just did that on my third opera. Only one song.
Oh, really? With what instrument?
Tony Mamone. With the guitar. It was pan hard left.
Oh, yeah.
And it's out of phase.
Yeah. It's easy to do. We actually ended
up. What song is it? Antlered Man. It's Antlered Man. So if you listen to Antlered Man.
Okay, cool.
The mono button, all of a sudden.
I'll look for it.
The guitar just goes for it.
We also, there was a like this thing where you could do that would make it. I forget what it's called, but it can take an image and make it sound more stereo. You know, it somehow plays with the phase.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what it was doing. I was just like trying to make this completely mono song sound more big or something.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I think it sounds good. And we were all like, it sounds good. But then Greg listens a lot of times when he's like mixing things on a. He plugs things into one speaker, one tiny little unpowered speaker to listen to it.
Yeah.
And the song would come on, and there was no sound. Completely no sound. And he's like, what is going on? Like, I know this song. And then he'd plug it into his stereo, and there's sound.
Yeah.
And that song, we had through doing this weird electronic process, made it completely out of phase. Like, 100%. So when you listen to it, it was gone.
Wow.
Which I was like, you know, that's kind of a good idea. We should do that. Leave it like that for the record. Like, just have this song just, like, only happens if, it, like, in certain circumstances. It would just be this mystery song. But we didn't.
What year is Reveille?
Ooh, I have no idea. I'm really bad at that kind of thing. Well, let's see. 2001 or something. Okay. When I joined, they were just finishing Half Bird, and I helped them finish it, and then we mastered it. But so yeah.
2000,
2001. I think 2001 maybe. Because it took us, yeah, definitely. Because it took us like 2 years to make.
And then you had a few more albums, and you just made one.
We just, yeah. Well, it's almost done.
Oh, it's got to be mixed in Portland.
Yeah, yeah.
Because Ed moved to Portland.
Yep.
And yeah, he don't have to travel.
Right, right, exactly. Well, we'll see. I think we'll all be doing lots of traveling. So sometimes, you know, we might end up meeting in other places. We'll see.
The first was playing with Greg. It's Tommy. And, you know, like, there's been a couple of manifestations you've gone through.
Yeah.
Is it different? Now this new one, yeah, with Ed, with the two guitars.
Yeah, you mean just, like, the feeling of the group?
Yeah, the dynamic.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know exactly how to talk about it. I'm very excited about what we're doing right now. I mean, we have, we've been playing live with two 12-string guitars.
Yeah.
And that's been, I mean, a little bit of a struggle, as you might imagine, in terms of intonation and whatever. But, like, yeah, it's a new sound, and I don't know. I just feel like we're always just trying to keep discovering things.
Do you ever play the bass?
Yeah, sometimes.
I know, I've seen Ed do it.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Actually, when I first saw Ed play, he was bass player for
XBXRX, right?
Yeah. It's a great show. They were penning the same outfits.
Yeah.
And they were leaping all over.
Yeah. Great. He has some amazing XBXRX stories, man.
I can imagine Chris or Vic.
Vice,
that's it. Vice Cooler. And his brother, right?
Yeah, Steve.
Interesting gentleman.
Yeah.
Very interesting gentleman. So, yeah, with the Deerhoof, you want to keep it moving. I guess that's the name of the band.
Yeah,
in
yeah.
In a way. Never been the same. My experience is at the gigs and listening to records, always want to keep changing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very inspiring.
Thank you.
You have this other band going from the first days.
Yeah, yeah. We're still going. We just recorded a new record in January, and we're going to attempt to finish it in the next year. And
did you ever pursue electronics?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I worked on at Mills. Actually, that's not what I worked on at Mills. That was one thing. When you got to Mills, anything goes. You just kind of, they just like work. And so I ended up doing almost no electronic music. But I still do things sometimes. But it's, you know, it's not like I'm building electronic instruments. It's just basically playing the sounds and like production, and like I think of all of that as part of that same thing. I mean, you're just dealing with these sounds in a computer or whatever.
yeah.
Even if it's like mixing a song.
Mm-hmm. It's been a trip, your journey.
Yeah.
Thanks for sharing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Block from Pedro Show. That was Deerhoof with My Purple Past. Before that, Big Spiel with John Dietrich, the guitarist with Deerhoof. Before the Spiel with John, we had some bands he played with. Treasure House in Amber by Gorge Trio. Before that, Living with Tigers by Gorge Trio. And before that, Plum Sign by the Gorge Trio. He talked about them some. And started all off with The Big Switch by Natural Dreamers. It was incredible for me to get to work bass with him. Nicholas rented, a 70s Fender P bass. Played pretty good. He was just going to take it direct, but then agreed to also use this little Ampeg. I sat down the whole time. He sat down too. He was on a stool playing the Les Paul. Can't remember what amp he was using because it was in another room. And I didn't check it out. But man, he was wailing on it. And very intuitive player too. Good listener. It's been the first hour of the September 5th, 2010 Watt from Pedro Show. Please hold tight for hour two. September 5th, 2010. It's the second hour of the Watt from Pedro Show.
Piano on this this unnamed proj,
right,
of the last 3 days here near the end of August in Austin.
Yeah, August in Austin.
3 days in a gin bay for me.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
And I never left the pad. My knee is still hurt, and so it's easier for me just, I could stay in one place. I'd never left the path.
No,
but there is there's a back hatch, and I did go on the porch.
Mm-hmm.
A few times, and there's quite a fly thing there happening. Well, I like to shout out. Tell them, how'd you get started with me? What when your littlest
memory
age?
Yeah.
Well, memory of music, hearing or doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, both of my parents are piano players.
Ah, so you started with music.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was really...
Hearing it when you were in the...
In the womb. Yeah, I'm sure. My mom was really passionate about music, and my dad... And she played, like, classical music, and studied in school for that. And I know your history a little bit,
Yeah.
So, you're listening.
Okay, yeah. So,
your mom and your pop are playing.
Right, my mom played, like, classical stuff, and my dad played in piano bars for years and years, all, like, golden oldies. And so they both, had a very different approach to the same instrument. I think that for sure has given me a particular type of education, my life.
What did they wanted you playing real early?
Well, my mom did for sure. Yeah. I actually didn't know my dad that well growing up. I got to know him after I was able to drive and go to him.
Right.
Did she
teach you or did you get lessons?
My mom taught me for a little while, but that didn't work out too well. So then she ended up
being dad trying to teach you how to drive.
Exactly.
I've taught.
Yeah, it was just
a lot of friends stick shift.
Uh huh.
After. Fathers having total insane breakdowns.
Right.
They don't have that connection's too close or something.
Yeah, I think
and,
so.
And you'll never do this. You do stupid shit. And, a couple weeks, I got them driving and stuff like that. But they just could not be calm.
Well, sometimes people just need a little patience and they get
it. Yeah, but the connection is the parent-child thing. Is
right, right. And that's how it was for me, for sure. But, I studied with other teachers, and I really did study. I mean, I grew up like that, like...
As a boy.
Yeah, as a boy, playing, all the, Bach and Scarlatti and Mozart
so
and
in school
Chopin
you had
and all that kind of stuff.
Music classes in school?
Some, yeah. Like, I was in the marching band in junior high and high school, No, I played trumpet.
Oh, okay.
I had some helpers, They had to keep me in the tuba section on the different ends of the football field, though. And And so, I was curious. I remember as a kid, like I used to climb inside of the piano, and I loved banging on the keys, and without any regard of what I was doing, just listening to the sounds. And
so were you writing?
I was improvising, I would say, you know.
Okay.
I mean, that's something that kids do naturally, right? I mean, they just like make sounds with stuff, right? And I kind of feel like I never
studying helped. All them composers.
I was doing that too. Yeah, and I ended up with a degree in composition and performance and from university and all that kind of stuff. So I followed that trajectory, but I also was curious about all kinds of different things. And
did you have bands with buddies?
Yeah, I had a band when I was 12 out in the countryside in the Santa Cruz Mountains. I remember it was maybe 6 months long or something. We played like Rush and Doors and things like that, you know.
Rush then, the band?
Yeah, right. Because they had keyboards in it, you know. So I was playing keyboards and stuff.
Yeah, did you find that there was kind of a weird thing against keyboards with rock and roll?
Well, it is. It's a weird instrument. I think it's hard to make it work, right?
Rock and roll started on the piano.
Right, I know.
Truth be told. I know, horn players and keyboard guys always get shit.
Yeah.
When we're young with the rock and roll bands, but
sure.
It's total denial about the truth of how rock started, because it is a piano instrument. Now, me and D. Boone didn't know anybody, because the electric pianos are organs and shit. This is the early 70s when we started playing. They were very expensive.
Right.
It wasn't like later.
Yeah.
And we didn't know anyone. Mm-hmm. You know anyone who played this stuff.
Wow.
Yeah. I know, the school had when there'd be guys playing piano in the school bands.
Mm-hmm.
Not marching band or anything, but in the auditorium and that stuff. There'd even be like a weird version of a jazz orchestra or something.
Mm-hmm.
And there'd be cats playing piano, but that's as close as we got to it.
Mm-hmm.
I remember a Univox came out. And it had a piano sound and a harpsichord sound and a maybe clavichord, clavinet. It had three sounds, and it was still like $400 or $500 for those days.
I know.
And one cat got it at high school. That was the first time. Then again, I was asked to play bass in a band for a talent show song. And the guy was a bass player, the best bass player in school, but he wanted to play piano. So he had me play some like kick drum part, boom, 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 boom. And this guy got bass underneath and he played piano. So that was the first time I played with a piano player. But did you encounter that stuff with rock? Like everybody wanted to rock the guitar. I mean,
I had a tune
bass. No one wanted to be rocking the bass in those days.
Yeah,
that's where you put the retarded friend, like the right field in Little League.
Yeah, I know.
They won't hit it out there, Fucking, I had no idea, but we knew every band had one, mostly. If you looked on the album cover, it was also arena rock, so we weren't very close.
Right.
So, but it seemed like everybody wanted to do the guitar. So I'm wondering about. And then you're in the classical music in this.
Right, and composing
so
and stuff.
You never got a chip, because some of them cats, rock and roll, this is like knucklehead shit. You're never worried about that.
Yeah, well, it's a different world, for sure, a different mentality, and the thing about classical music, I mean, there's a lot of great stuff in that world that I learned, but it's also, it lays a lot of baggage on you, too. And,
why?
Well, I think it's a... this could be a long conversation, topic. But first of all, there's so much emphasis on reading music, on playing the music the way it's supposed to be played,
As intended.
As intended, or as interpretedly intended.
Yeah, because there's no way that medium really hits it over, right?
And also something I started to realize that a lot of these composers were freaks.
Yeah, sure.
And but then, it somehow it became conventional over the years.
Yeah.
I mean, the approach to this music became conventional. I learned from playing that stuff that I should be making my own, you know?
Yeah.
That became pretty clear to me. And that's not the case for a lot of classical players, you know?
They execute.
They execute.
A few.
Yeah. Yeah. But I actually ended up, like, I quit school after 3 years, and this was during the run-up to the Persian Gulf War, you know?
Early 90s.
Yeah, early 90s, and I started a band called the 100th Monkey Generation, the difference between everything anarchists can do, whether or not the cops will let us band. And the name got longer and longer as we had different experiences, you know, so the name itself kind of tells the story of the band.
Woods.
No.
The Woods Band.
No, right. This was when I was...
What was the name of that band?
Oh, I don't even remember that. Sorry, but...
I told you Bright Orange,
12 years
man.
Old is a bit of a blur for me.
I told you about Bright Orange, man.
No, this is... I was like 23. No, I must have been 21, I guess. And so, and we played... Like, we didn't play one gig for money. But we played all up and down the coast. We played the... Nevada nuclear test site on Shoshone land there a couple of times. Did a 5-day walk and played every night for the dinners out in the middle of the desert.
You pushing that piano right?
Again, yeah. I'm a lot stronger than I look. but yeah, then we played like.
Do you ever play standing up?
Yeah. Yeah, I do.
Okay,
but
you know, I always wanted to have an organ band since I heard Sister Ray when I was more younger. And I finally got a trio called Second Man.
Right.
And I remember we're going on tour, and I guess no one ever talked about this, but here's the first gig in Tempe, and the organ man, Pete Mazage, pulls out this fucking stool. And I said, you think I'm going to be the only one standing up there?
That's right.
So right. He, you know, he's a longshoreman. He knows. So you put the... Okay. And he jettisoned the stool.
Right.
And he's been playing standing up with me. I never thought about it being an issue.
Yeah, I don't. I really wish that it would be easier to stand up. I mean, it's hard to play a piano at the height that it's at.
You
gotta
work the pedal.
Well, the pedal and also the angle of your arms coming at the keyboard is totally wrong.
Oh.
You really have to have a parallel. Your arm has to be parallel to the keyboard. That's the best way to play.
So, like a Hammond organ, like you're allowed to like dive.
Well, sure.
The way he plays, he gets actually big old hurts and shit on.
Yeah.
Because he.
He plays it with the wrong side of his hands.
Yeah, and this kind of thing, you know, it's like those things called glisses.
Yeah.
Wow. Swears, and he just never sat down again.
Oh,
from that first, I just was feeling alone. Because the drummy's already on a throne. Uh-huh. You know, these Buffy's guys are going to be looking at me, and I'm standing there and say, come on, Pete. Help me out. What he did, he chopped the organ and put steel foldable legs.
Right. Then it could get high enough.
And you can get in the boat.
And you can get in the boat.
You know what I mean? It's right. Still 250 pounds. Mm-hmm. But that other shit, those Hammonds, I think, were built just to go in a place and stay.
For sure.
It's a 65 Hammond B3.
Or Arena Rock, one or the other.
Or some other dudes are lifting it, right?
Exactly.
And that same goes for the speaker. A lot of it's that speaker, that Leslie.
Right, the Leslie. Yeah.
It's a great sound. But get on with the anarchist band.
Yeah, okay. So, so we were doing, like, protests and benefits and all this kind of stuff, you know, playing in the street.
And politics.
Yeah, it was totally a political band. Yeah,
was that like the Rush band in the woods?
No, that band was just 12-year-olds.
Oh,
you know.
It was 12, that young.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah, that was my first band.
Yeah, okay.
This was, I mean, we put it together particularly to protest. And then it kind of dissolved at some point, and then I did nothing but at that. I did nothing but protests and political organizing and a lot of environmental work up like in Humboldt County. So that's what I did for quite a few years, actually.
Stopped playing piano?
I pretty much stopped playing the piano for a while. And I think that was really good for me because it kind of like broke, you know, like habits and ways of looking at music for me. And so when I came back to it, you know, I was really fresh, you know.
What got you going back to it?
Well, I kind of woke up from, in a way, from like all this protest and demonstrating and organizing and all that, and thought, what the fuck have I done? You know, the world is, you know, is still, you know, fucked up, you know, and I felt like I had sacrificed years of my life, you know, to not be really effective. And then I kind of thought, well, I think music is my best way to interact with the world, to you know, add something good to it. So then that's why I came back to music. But even then,
in the woods,
right? Yeah, you know, I lived in tents in the woods for quite a while in the mountains, and
now you're doing stuff music. Like
that. No, this was before the music, in between or whatever.
So when you come back, no, I'm trying to get back.
Yeah.
When you bring back, you start a band, or would you go back to your classical, or what?
Yeah, I was playing on and off with this bass player that from the 100th Monkey Generation, band.
From the old band.
And then I was doing, like, just to make money, I was accompanying, like, for opera and modern dance and this kind of stuff. And because I'm a good reader. And it's a skill I have, and I can do it, but I hate it. So, I mean, it was really, I was pretty miserable. But I was able to make some money doing that. And then it was, for a couple of years of just, like, piecing together stuff just to make enough money to eat and pay for some rent, you know. And then it was about 8 years ago. I had kind of like a nervous breakdown, I guess. The only difference was I knew exactly what I had to do, which was to just take a leap and focus only on my own music. Wow. And fuck even trying to make money. I mean, just like that. And my wife has been really supportive. I mean, she's incredible. So, but it's working, you know. I mean, now I'm traveling around the world. I'm playing with you guys. I'm, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Well, but probably then, John, too. You guys, back in those days when you started, you never could imagine it, and I mean, that's the way it is with me.
Right, yeah, exactly.
I just got into music to be with my friend. Uh-huh. I never thought it'd be a way of a life.
Yeah, totally.
No idea.
Definitely not.
Yeah, the different paths of getting to this point is, I mean, it's a mystery, and who knows what's going to happen tomorrow, and, you know, all that.
Yeah.
But I'm along for the ride.
But Tom, the first time I saw you play, we played together, right?
Shared a bill?
Yeah, right? The bottom of the hill, right?
Bottom of the hill. Not Olympia?
No, that was with Curtains, I think.
Oh, okay. Right.
And then, but maybe it wasn't something we played together. Maybe I just was at a show that you played. But I just remember you, I think at the time it was a duo, right?
Mm-hmm, with Rick Rivera.
Rick Rivera, yeah. So how did that band start? Because that's a whole interesting thing. Like, was that time that you formed that?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it was. It was when I had this kind of pseudo nervous breakdown or whatever it was. And, right after this decision that I made in my life that I had to focus on my music.
No compromise.
Exactly, yeah. I met this great guy, Rick Rivera, and an incredible drummer. And I asked him if he wants to play some music with me. And so, fortunately, he had a rehearsal space, too, so that was good. You know, like old days, right? You got a band? Yeah. Okay, man, that's let's go.
Drummers.
Yeah, exactly. So,
you had the shed.
And I had all kinds of compositions and different kind of structured improvisations and songs and so on. So we made two albums together, he and I, of most
what
of my
stuff.
Call it Tom Rivera, my first name and his last
and
name.
And that's what you saw?
Yeah. It was completely
Bomb in the Hill.
Yeah.
They're alive.
Yeah.
Bad.
Yeah. Yeah, that was my introduction to your music, and it just felt, it was just so like, this is like, what?
Yeah, what is this? You made two albums? Can you show me some music?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Play on the show?
Oh, absolutely.
I never heard it.
Okay, yeah.
The stuff I know, you're from with Sigourney first.
Right.
Remember?
Right.
Those guys, just by chance, they were friends of the Sonio de Maranao guys.
Right. Nipozano!
Yeah, the Paisanos, that was the connection.
Right.
So I started playing it. That's my connection. So you can fill me in with some of that.
Oh, yeah, I will. Yeah, I got some stuff with me. I'll look through it and, yeah, of course, share anything I have.
Maybe.
Yep. Tim?
Mr. Barnes.
Thank you, Wyatt. No, it's a pleasure, man. It's been a pleasure getting to know you and play music with you. And
no kidding. It's really been an experience.
It's been great. So, okay. Goodbye, everybody.
Pot from Pedro Show. Here in Pedro, here in my pad, not with Brother Matt. Man alone. Started the second hour off with some stuff pertaining to Tullah McDonough. Tullah McDonough's incredible piano player, classically trained and all that, but well, he said in his spiel there. We started off with some music, like I said, he's involved with, like, I guess he had these duos. I think this duet, Tholem Rivera, was the first thing John Dietrich saw. I think they were, say, in the bottom of the hill or something, up in San Francisco. And we started off with I Know the Language. Third time fourth time now. Then we heard March 13, 2004, Tholem Rivera again. Then we heard something. He did a duet with a piano guy. This is Tullah McDonough's Nicola Guazzaloca and Winnings for Backings. And then that music prefaced his spiel with me about his journey through music. Interesting trip and journey. I played much Sigodi on this show of mine, and Tullah McDonough's member of Sigodi, along with Matteo and Andrea Jacopo. Great cats. Great band. I'll play more Sigodi. A third album's coming. I mean, it's recorded everything. It's coming. Let's see here. I wanted to talk about a little bit the gigs. People ask me, how do I do these Stooges gigs with the bad knee? Well, I get up on stage a little early, and I'm on the side there with the crutches and the knee immobilizer on. Knee immobilizer won't let the port side knee bend. You know, it's got steel in it. It's got germs colors, black and blue, so it's kind of cool. And when I get a sense James Williamson's running up there, trotting out there, I begin my crutch on over, and Mr. Slouch or Mr. Joss, they'll trade me the bass for the crutches. And so I'm not playing with crutches, and I'm not sitting down on the riser. I'm standing there, stovepipe leg, and doing it. Here's some more music. A lot from Pedro Show. Thank you.
Thank you. mountains and prairies, destructively we can overcome as one. Symbolically we live life in all lanes, ideally body is one as one. You say a thing called the Chalking Mountain, and the gods who presume the laydown. But I speak for financial freedom, and I'm God, I am the I am me. I am the boss of me, I am the boss of me.
Thank you.
From Pedro Show. Started that follow-up on Tyler McDonough's chunk of music with Position Normal doing Going Gong. Yeah, I was told by their main man that he wants to try a new direction. I've played so much Position Normal because I love him on this show. I think he's... Yeah, I dig it. You know, he lets a freak flag fly. Then we heard something from Japan, Gensan, by King Otama. Then we heard Bands by the Dyna Band. And then from Creamy Electric Santa. I know those cats from somewhere way back. Well, they did Workaholics Paradise Lost and Found. And finally we did Revolution Town by Son of Dave. Now, Son of Dave opened up two Stooges gigs in France in the month of July. And it was the second one. No, it wasn't. It was the first one I did with them, or the Stooges did with them, and I played the work, the bass. Where my knee went out. It went out on the last note of the first song in Istres, France. Oh, man. You know what? I'm thinking, King Otama or whatever, there's a new album out by the Karoo Crew. Let me play one of their tunes for you here. Watt from Pedro Show. Thank you. Watt from Pedro show. Now, was that wild or what? That was the wild ride. It was number four from Crew Crew, their new album, ready to come pop right out. They flowed one to me, Mr. Nels. Nels Klein was blown away. Of course, I got to actually play with them February 2008, toured Japan, smoking band. Yeah, incredible. It was at Haiti. Yeah. But part of it was trippy. It was not a live house. It was a different gig than all the rest on that tour. We did 14 gigs in 14 days, again with my brothers in light. And Tatsunori? Yeah. Great cat. Artist, too. Band Up. Was in this pad, and man, that was one of my favorite gigs of that tour. Also like Nagoya too. Tokusu, I think, was the name of the pad. What's the name of that pad? Tokuzo. And Miss Yuko tore it up on the drums. I mean, it was wild. But Kuru Kuru, great, great band. And this new album they got. And one tune, I've played it on my show already, but the singer man for 5471? Do I have those numbers right? Yeah, Bingo. Bingo Sons on one of the songs. Great stuff. We're at the end of the second hour. Watt from Pedro show. Hold tight for hour three. September 5, 2010. It's the third hour of the Watt from Pedro show.
the drum man with us is Tim Barnes. And Tim, when was you first getting music experience?
Pretty early on. I mean, music was always... None of my parents really played music. My dad played, you know, clarinet in high school or something like that, but nothing real significant. And both my parents liked music, though, and my mom especially was always in our house. I mean, we listened to the Beach Boys and Jackson 5 and Motown. And
you were in California.
Southern California, late 60s and 70s. And then Creedence and... Even like later, you know, like my mom was like really got into that Kansas, like Dust in the Wind.
Yeah, D. Boone knew how to play that.
And but it was always there.
Here's a little thing: we were at a talent show.
Yeah.
But like by City of Torrance, not school, and this drummer guy with chrome plated drums asked me and D. Boone to back him up, and there was a hippie lady singer, and D. Boone choked on it. Couldn't believe it. Like, it had some fancy ass finger picking guitar.
Yeah.
And but D. Boone didn't even not even wince on his face. Like, then nothing happened here.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, I'm playing it right. It choked so big time. But yeah, it was like this total balls out face. There's nothing wrong here. You're hearing it wrong. This is the problem.
Your ears were somehow a half step off.
It was
every once in a while. Yeah.
It was like 30 story chutzpah. He just rolled that baby through. I was so impressed. Yeah. Sorry.
No, that's all right. I mean, it's
like Kansas, your mom like.
Well, she, you know, she did. It was just, I think, a part of the progression of where music was going at the time. I mean, she was listening to a lot of stuff that bands that she liked when she was in college and high school and stuff. Like,
yeah.
I was saying Motown and Beach Boys and stuff, and some surf music, Dick Dale and stuff like
that.
Yeah. Came into the scene, and then, but as music progressed, you know, like, you know, as you got into the 70s and stuff, and then, you know, Kansas kind of like entered into our house. But I think at that time too, music like rock and roll, I think, had made its this huge leap into living rooms, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like Sonny and Cher show, the Dottie and Marie show, and
Mac Davis.
You know, yeah, the Bay City Rollers had a show, you know. I mean, it was like it was everywhere, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
An uncle of mine, my mom's youngest brother, had a little drum set over at my grandparents' house, a little four-piece Pearl set, and man, when I first saw that, you know, I was just like, you know,
well,
we'd go down and play, and bang on it until someone would come down and throttle me to stop. And then you know, that kind of continued for a few years, and finally, you know, I think, I don't know, for my 11th birthday or something like that, my uncle, you know, finally gave me the drum set.
Wow.
And my dad was so bummed.
Yeah, because
he hated it. And
the Pounderoni?
Yeah.
The Ponderosa?
And, but, you know, I really had no, I had no interest in really learning how to play drums. I think I just liked the idea of just, like, banging this thing. And there was a guy who lived two doors down from me that was, like, you know, quintessential, like, 70s rock drummer, you know, and he was probably, I think he was, like, you know, he was an older guy, like, maybe, like, he was going to, like, junior college or something like that nearby, and like, he'd be playing in the afternoon, and he'd be sitting out, and, you know, he'd be riding your skateboard on the block, and he'd just, and I was just like, wow. And then I think my mom convinced him to like try to give me a couple lessons, and that didn't it didn't really go anywhere. Then Kiss entered into my life.
Oh, Peter Criss played Pearl.
Yeah. And
by coincidence.
And I remember hearing their Kiss Alive, and I think that was really like the first introduction to that, and then hearing the drum solo on 100,000 Years, all the phasing, you know, sort of stuff. And
I remember that bass line.
Did he really say you must have been a bitch while I was gone?
Yeah, right.
Wow.
Or something that Paul Stanley
voice.
You know.
Oh yeah.
Take that. I remember that record.
Go Jim!
Right, right. So that got you wanting to really go on.
Yeah, that got me, you know, into it. And I think, again, but it was more this sort of, like, the idea of it. And I think, again, like, then, like, that be, like, lip-syncing and stuff. Like, I remember, you know, me and buddies would sit around, you know, with, like, tennis rackets and fake drums and stuff.
Maybe how's like, we did it with baseball bats.
Yeah.
They played the 45 and fake.
Yeah, yeah.
This is before I knew D. Boone. I didn't even know anything about music, but it was maybe because that Monkees TV show. I don't know.
Right?
What it
yeah,
was.
There's that was another music thing, you know.
You know, where I had no idea of music, but they were like doing it, and
yeah.
So we had baseball bats and playing stupid fucking 45.
Yeah. The vacuum cleaner with the, you know, turned up handle at the top with the microphone, you know. And yeah, Elton John too. You know, like there was something like. All these bands that were kind of coming out, they were kind of like bigger than life, you know, and they were all over the place. I think rock and roll had found this huge marketing, yeah. you know, void that yeah. they filled. You know, you'd go to JCPenney's and you'd see, you know, Parliament and Kiss and Elton John, you know, all just right there, you know, Joe Walsh and, you know.
JCPenney's.
I remember seeing the cover of, like, his record, like, front something, not Joe Walsh, who's that guy? French Kiss, where the lady's like got her tongue. Like
Welsh,
like
Bob Welsh.
Bob Welsh.
Yeah, was a Fleetwood Mac guitarist.
I remember sitting there.
Ebony Eyes.
What is that, man? That's like. I don't even know what
Joe
that
Walsh had a band after James Gang called Barnstorm.
I
and it was the
band.
Smoker you drink, the player you get. And the big song was Rocky Mountain Way. And he used this tube.
Oh, wow.
In his mouth, yeah. A Pete Frampton.
Oh, yeah.
Took that idea took even right way further. Totally. Well, he didn't take the idea further, but he got very much more popular.
Yeah.
With it.
But there was, and then I think it, then kind of music sort of like for me maybe started taking a little bit of a backseat, and I think that music was when I heard the I remember like the bands like the Eagles and all these sort of like big kind of bands that. We're still kind of speaking to people my parents' age and stuff like that. Just depressed the hell out of me. I hated it. Just was just like, what? You know, I didn't get it at all. And then, you know, later on, I mean, Southern California was a pretty cool place, you know, for music, I think. And
early 80s.
Yeah, when you got to, like, early 80s and late 70s, it was it got really exciting.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I got into middle school, it was, you know, B-52s and Devo and stuff, and that was the idea of, that's when, like, the idea of a band, you know, you could have a band, like, kind of came up, you know, these first images of, like, wow, if, you know, if I could really play the drums, or if I could really play an instrument, this, we could do music like this, you know, this would be cool to, like, do something like this.
Yeah.
And I was also involved in the skateboarding scene, so that was also a really great way of listening to music.
Right,
and,
right.
And hearing about stuff. Mm-hmm. And then here comes the movie Decline of Western Civilization.
And then
right before then, my friends had we had discovered the you know the Sex Pistols record and the Clash now and stuff and then but now here then it's like there's all this English stuff and then all this punk rock that was on our you know on our turf
not
you know
foreign.
Kind of thing it wasn't foreign it was right then and there and seeing that movie and hearing you know that music was just that even pushed that idea even further like okay we could play music me and my friends could. Play music.
So meanwhile, you got the drums. You're like doing on it, but
yeah, but not
no
really.
Band.
Not really. I still couldn't. I was in a band before I really even knew how to add the bass drum into the mix.
Whoa.
You know, I could do this high-end. And you know and the and all this kind of stuff and you know do pretty spastic fills. Not much different than I did like yesterday in the last couple of days. But
Yeah, you got that bass drum in there.
like three or four bass drum hits I heard.
But so I think in the same year I saw the Decline of Western Civilization and that kind of like pushed this idea further. And then I saw The Kids Are All Right and saw early footage of Keith Moon at the same time. So while me and my friends were like trying to see who could play Red Tape the best on the drums, all of a sudden I see this footage of Keith Moon playing I Can't Explain and just this kid was just so young and just had this little four-piece set and the everything's like wobbling all over the place because he's hitting it so hard and it's so fast. I'm just like, I'd never seen anything like it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's when it was just like, that's what I want to do, you know. And so a buddy of mine, I just made him sit with me for hours and hours until I finally learned how to do the doom on the, you know, on the one and the three.
Yeah, yeah.
And just like get it into my, you know, like patting your head and rubbing your belly, you know, that coordination into myself. And then it kind of took off from there. But shortly after, my family moved to New York, and then where I knew no one. So
yeah.
My first couple months of being in New York was sitting down, and we had a basement. This was the first time we ever had a basement, you know. It was like, well, California doesn't have basements.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
Like, so here we are, and we have a basement, and my drums are down there, and I would just, you know, put a record on, put my headphones on, and just play all day long. And again, until like my mom came down with tears, just like, could you please stop? my level went up, of playing. And then, but then when I got to school, there was very few musicians, you know. And when I got to New York, Long Island, everyone had a totally different trip of like, there weren't a lot of people that, everyone played like from a chops perspective.
Yeah.
You know, everything was like,
yeah,
you know, hey, you, I think coming from like New York City or whatever, or this, there's like this real proficiency. Whereas, you know, in California, me and my friends, we all just sort of like taught ourselves.
Yeah,
the first
band
I played in, we played, you know, 80% of the music we played was surf music, and then the other percent was like Ramones and, you know, stuff like that. And, but when you got back here, it was all like, God, it was, you know, it was the
Rush
and all this kind of stuff. And I remember meeting like one guy named Dave Pearson who like, he was the guy who like turned me on to like Joy Division and, you know, stuff like that. And more like, you know, newer English stuff. And he was into punk rock too. And, you know, had an older brother, I guess, who like turned him on to a lot of stuff. And, but there was no, there was a void to a certain extent with like...
What you missed from back in Cali.
Yeah, a little bit, you know, but I would try to like get these sort of guys together, try to pull them in
and try to create
something new or whatever, but it always kind of fell on its face and that was like all through high school and stuff. And then after college is when it really kind of like stepped up. I met these guys. One night I drove all the way from Long Island to go to Hoboken to see Shonen Knife play.
Oh.
And it was just a great show. And
Maxwell's.
Yeah, Maxwell's. And there was an ad on the bulletin board on my way out, and I just happened to catch it, you know, and just like grabbed it. I called these guys, and, you know, a couple weeks later we started playing, and it went really well. It was just like, wow, this is cool.
Just from an ad.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Damn.
And the two guys had been kind of Tim Newman and this guy Christian Bavacqua. They had been playing together for a while and then their drummer left, and that's what.
Yeah.
But when I came in, I think I brought this idea of like, hey, we need to get out on the road. We need to tour. Let's go tour. Let's make some records. Let's put out our own records, you know. And this is how we do it. And
is this your label?
We had it was all of ours. Like we started just the band. It was like the band's thing, you know. We decided that was the course we wanted to take. You know, there was a couple times when some people had offered to put some stuff out for us, and we kind of like, you know, it'd be like, yeah, that'd be cool, and then we'd stop for a second, and be like, no, it wouldn't. It wouldn't be cool. We had to just do it ourselves. You know,
yeah.
Like we all have day jobs. We can, you know, put up the money to do it. And if anything should happen with this band, at least all this stuff is ours and, you know, no one else.
Right, right.
So we just stayed on that path and just started playing, you know, in New York as much as we could and stuff and started getting meeting a lot of people and everything. And and it got some smaller labels in the city interested, and these people that would say, oh yeah, you should come down this to here, and found ourselves playing some like festival down in D.C. And so we met, you know, some of that scene a little bit, a lot of that indie rock. This is all that in, you know, the 93, 94,
yeah,
you know, and on. yeah, it was really cool because I've started meeting people who was like 7 inches I had, you know, and that was kind of a big deal.
Yeah, sure.
Me, you know, I started like
the people okay, that actually play.
Yeah, and it's like the. Mm-hmm. I think I always kind of like had this idea about rock that there was like this. There's always this possibility of a community.
Yeah.
You know, a community of people that, you know, maybe not you weren't all like best of friends or anything like that, but there was like this rapport that you always that you could have with other musicians. And I at first I found that it was very I didn't find that a lot. You know, everyone was so competitive and know, I had this like guard and like fuck you and
right.
You know, well, we played this place. Where are you gonna play? And you know, like all this kind of just like weird, this kind of just weird shit. But as this band, we were called Ditch Croaker, and as it kind of went down the path, we started discovering more and more of this kind of community, and it was really cool, and getting people, you know, like, no one, it was always cool going into a place when no one knew you, and all these people knew each other and everything like that, get up on stage, and you kind of earned something after your set, you know, that kind of people like. And I remember it was when we went to this festival in D.C., it was like, I think we were kind of intimidated going into it because we knew the backyard of all these Tsunami and Velocity Girl and Fugazi and, you know, all these people, you know. And from an outsider's perspective, all those people were best friends with all those, you know, everyone else, and all these bands they played together and toured together and made records together and were on each other's labels and all this kind of stuff. And so we were kind of the odd guys out at this thing. But after the first song, you know, some dude shouts out, "Who are you guys?" You know, and we didn't even respond back. We just kind of like kept it like tight and just sort of just went on with the set and just tried to like. Pounded into these people. Yeah. And that was a really great moment in the whole thing. But what was cool is that then it just sort of, like everything else, developed into more touring. We loved touring. We loved going out. We all had like really good flexibilities in our jobs. You know, we lived in New York and it wasn't easy. You know, we always had to like have, you know, some decent job just to like. Pay our rent and stuff like that.
Spend it down.
Yeah. And we weren't making lots of money on the road at all. I mean, we were just, whatever we could get, you know, was, you know. I mean, I remember a buddy of mine, one of the guys in the band got married recently, and I was trying to dig through some paraphernalia to kind of like talk about it at his wedding, and I came across an envelope that was like cash, you know, like a cash envelope from like, you know.
Money sack.
Yeah. And next to each, you know, I would have written down the venue and then how much we took in.
Yeah.
Man, there was like probably like 12 dates or something like that on this one envelope, and there was not one gig that was like over like $75 or something
right.
You know, it's like.
Yeah. I know.
But what was wild that then, okay, so that band, and then, but like, 5 years later, I'd go out as just like a, you know, hired guy with a band, and minimum people were getting like $150, you know, you know, it was like all these like guarantees and stuff like that. It was just like, wow, we definitely, part of us did it right, but a part of us, you know, did it horribly wrong in terms of like, you know,
it's all about rolling the dice too.
Yeah, but we took
situation, the scene, the thing you roll into. Tour is weird because they're not your worlds, really. You visit them.
Yeah.
If you tour regularly a little bit, but still, you're not in charge of those scenes.
And I was just, you know, and I think we just wanted to make sure we could connect the dots.
Yeah.
Every day, you know, and have as few days off, and it meant playing for whatever money came through the door.
Yeah.
That's what we had to end
up doing. I know. We were there, too. Our first tours were booked by Chuck Dukowski. I remember one time it was in Sacramento. And can't find the pad, so the promoter's address is there, and go knock on his, you know, he's living with his mom and shit. He won't open that hatch. You guys are playing? Yeah. Where? I don't know. You're putting it on. What? Yeah. Well, look, you find out where you're playing, and I'll go there tonight. Motherfucker. Not all the time, but sometimes.
Yeah, you know. Yeah, right, right.
You had to call the clubs in town and say, hey, are we playing there?
No, see, he dropped the fucking ball and never called the Kowski. Yeah, that's what happened.
Yeah,
he's
yeah.
too ashamed and shit. I'm glad we went to the door, though, and we're, like, pounding on it. Yeah, yeah. George, he's like... We were a little pissed, but we let it go. Yeah. Ended up a day off. Whoa, those are very rare for a Minuteman tour. Yeah. So, how long does the Ditch Croaker go?
All the way up through 97. And 93 to 97. And we end up... I mean, we had an opportunity that we couldn't refuse to a certain extent, or we felt like we couldn't refuse, and that was an opportunity to sign with Reprise Records.
Yeah.
And after like long deliberation and just a lot of stress and strife about whether we should do it, we decided to do it.
Yeah.
And we hired Richard Grable as our lawyer,
and he
nailed us a pretty good deal. And it was very bizarre. Reprise wanted to sign us for 3 records.
Yeah,
and I think from what we heard, that was like a pretty odd thing for a label like that to do at that time.
Yeah,
in that sort of just what the scene was within record labels. You know?
Yeah.
And so Grable goes right in and says, okay, well, if you're going to sign up for 3 records, that's cool, but if you drop them at any point, you have to pay half of the remaining recording budgets. And he gets that into the end of the contract. Plus, we get in the contract that they have got to buy us a new, you know, we need a new van and, you know, all this stuff. Yeah, so we got a pretty great setup. And, you know, as soon as we signed on the line, though, we knew we were fucked. We knew it was like we're so cooked, you know.
Man.
Like, because we weren't, you know, it was like we were 3 dudes who, you know, we just loved making what we do, what we did. None of us were like, you know, I don't think we really weren't swinging for the fence or anything like that, or had these like grand schemes of like, you know, wearing some, you know, having our own clothesline or anything like that. Yeah, and we loved smoking the weed while we. Created and played and just existed and being out there, you know, that was part of just what we did. And it was, and so, yeah, we knew we weren't going to fit in. And we were such control freaks in a way. I mean, we wanted to do everything on our own terms. And so,
we were used to it.
I think Reprise just, I think they totally hated us. because they're like, oh Jesus, we gotta call them and see what they want to do about radio promotion. And we'd always be like, okay, who's gonna do it? And what did they do before? And what's their, you know, how did they? We wanted to make sure that we were gonna be taken care of, and not be like, oh yeah, sounds great. And you know, how much? You know, don't ask how much it's gonna cost us or anything. You know, it's like we were just very, you know, I think we were just very particular, and we had that mindset. You know, we had learned from a lot of people that came before us, you know, about look after yourselves.
Yeah, yeah.
There was a lot of, you know, it was the beginning of an era when there was access to information and stuff was getting a lot easier, you know, and so you could read stories about people that had come before us and, you know, where things went wrong and where things went right and stuff like that. So.
And so, how did things go wrong?
Just because of that
scene.
Scene
just died.
And within the band, it was like classic, you know, people wanting to do other stuff, you know, like one guy wants to make it more, you know, complex and more singing and all this kind of stuff, and another guy wants to keep it the way it is, and, you know, I wanted to make things, I don't know, just, try to reach for some kind of new kind of sounds and stuff like that, and it's just sort of like it just kind of fell apart, and you know, just almost as quickly as it came together, really too.
Wow.
So it was, but we're, you know, it's like we all kind of still hang, but you know, it was what was cool though about that whole time was that I was working at a film editing company called Lost Planet in New York City, and the guy who ran it, this guy Hank Corwin. was really like a sound based editor, and so he couldn't, he didn't like cutting a frame of film without a huge palette of sound.
Yeah.
And so one of my jobs, I was assisting him for a while, and one of my jobs was to go into this, he had this little studio, I'd just go and make things, you know, like, and he would want, you know, it was like, Tim, imagine like the synapses of someone's brain like firing off. Go in and make something like that. You know? It was like those kind of, that kind of direction, you know, and
pretty creative situation.
Yeah, it was. And he had, you know, and he exposed me to a lot of cool music that I hadn't like heard before, and composers and stuff like that. And so that kind of pushed me in this, you know, direction that stretched out of the you know, indie rock sort of like pop music kind of
Did you end up leaving New York?
Yeah, it was still, you know, a ways down, you know, because New York became, like, after Ditch Croker,
I started playing
with, like, a bunch of other people and, like, did a lot of Sideman.
Yeah.
Silver Jews, you know. Then I met Jim O'Rourke and played on a bunch of his records and then Pullman, and then within New York, started playing with Matt Valentine from Tower Recordings a lot, and all these things were just, God, it was such great experiences and just amazing growth as a musician, but also just like as a, you know, being exposed to different ideas about music. I mean, you know, the ideas that Matt Valentine has about music versus like Jim's, you know, two totally different things, you know. But it was really great to play, you know, within both those things. And, you know, and then getting so far into it that, you know, doing like, playing with these European improvisers, these guys, it was just all about like texture, you know, like real quiet micro sounds, you know, and doing that for a couple of years, and then playing with like John Zorn and a lot of the other like you know, sort of like the classic, you know, whatever downtown, just the improv scene in New York was very healthy at that period and everything, and it just kind of all went up to this point, you know, and everything was like really great, and then I just kind of switch one off, and I went out like a fucking dead light bulb. I didn't know what I was doing. Didn't have an idea. I was like, well, I didn't know where I wanted to go. You know?
Yeah.
And it was so I just stopped. I didn't have an answer.
Yeah.
So I just stopped.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when shortly after that I left New York, my family, my wife Erica and I, and left New York and took our son Jackson with us and down to Louisville and hung out and just been living there. But then Louisville, you can't go to Louisville without somehow getting involved in music. And started playing with the Four Carnation, which is Brian McMahon, who was in Slint. Played with him all last year, and which sort of culminated in playing the ATP 10th anniversary show in the UK right before Christmas. And one of the coolest parts of that whole trip was reconnecting with Deerhoof.
Watt from Pedro Show. Start off the third hour with some music that involves Mr. Tim Barnes, a drumming man I had the great honor to play with for the first time last week in Austin, Texas. Maybe 2 weeks now. Sorry. The recording was during August 22nd, 23rd to 25th. 3 days. And the third day is when I did these spiels with John, Tullum, and Tim. And we heard some of Tim's drumming on these tunes starting off the third hour. Right Hand of the Brain by Ditch Croker. He spoke of them in the spiel. Not Sport, Martial Arts by Jim O'Rourke. Jim O'Rourke, a great cat, of course. Much respect from me.
for him as well as Mr. Tim. We had some conversations about Mr. Jim, and yeah, he's a remarkable man, we both agree. And then A Draft of Shadows by Barnes, Kajiwara, and Rosenfeld. And to show you, he's got some vocabulary, Mr. Tim, there. And quite a story from California, New York to Louisville. I can dig it. And much respect. All three cats, Mr. Tim, Mr. Tom, Mr. John. Of course, Mr. Nicholas for getting it together. I was very, very grateful, and am now, too, for being invited aboard. Try my best to work some decent bass for them. There was tunes. There was improvise. Yeah, it'll be a trip when it comes out. Well, it was a trip when we made it, but I kind of let go after that and let them put that hunk of clay on the wheel and spin it. And very much hankering big time to see how the Akachan is born. Truly righteous. All three very much individuals, but very open to listening to each other. And what I find important about more than one person playing, an interesting conversation. Let's hear some more music, okay?
He said, you think you're so cool. She said, don't act like a fool. They go back and forth at one another. Just like a sister and her brother. Guess that's just the way for lovers.
He said,
you think you're so right.
She said,
don't try to pick a fight. They go back and forth at one another. Just like a sister and her brother. Guess that's just the way for lovers. They go back and forth at one another. Just like a sister and her brother. Guess that's just the way for lovers. Thank you.
From Pedro Show. Last chunk of music for this edition started with He Said, She Said by Shell Shag. Hard to say. I just saw them in Brooklyn. Good people. Then Hiba Walazola by Ichi. I think he just played in London. And Horoyori, a live cut from Noshinto, which is a band Ichi used to be in. And finally, Fukai Mori by Jago, another Nihon band. It's been the September 5th, 2010 edition of the Watt from Pedro Show. Everybody, happy Labor Day, and keep your powder dry.